At the COP27 meetings in Egypt last week, Antonio Guterres, Secretary General of the United Nations, opened the conference with a stark warning and call to action. "We are in the fight of our lives and we are losing," he said. "We are on a highway to climate hell with our foot on the accelerator." Well, looking at the midterm elections here in the US, the largest contributor historically to global warming, results so far suggest that we have pulled back a bit from that accelerator. Many of the election deniers and climate deniers did not win their elections, including Christine Drazin, who ran for governor and lost to Tina Kotek. So, Mike, let's look at a few of the highlights and the lowlights of the midterms and then turn to COP27 meetings in Egypt that were sidelined by the drama of the midterms. What about the governor's race? Should we start there?
Well, let's do because it's a stark example of how and why these days voting for Democrats is a must. And I know full well that the Democrats are every bit as bad as the Republicans on issues of war and peace.
Well,
If
you
you
know, though, how the old saying goes that the Democratic Party is a graveyard of progressive movements.
I know that. And when it comes to banks, for example, who brought the whole world to a precipice in 2008, the Democrats are every bit as bad as the Republicans. But the fossil fuel industry, the third blob of power after the military industrial complex and the banks or the oil companies, and here there's been a really interesting and important split. The Democrats, because of, I sense, maybe beginning with Al Gore, but certainly, most recently, are finding sources of revenue to support their political campaigns from alternate energy sources. And for various reasons, they are becoming a real alternative. And it's a big world out there, and they make a big difference not only in those social issues like abortion that the big blobs of power don't really care about, but also they're enabling us to seriously take on the issue of climate change. And I think the difference in the reasons why are clearly illustrated by Oregon's governmental race.
Yeah, Drazin, an anti-abortion conservative, of course, was also, she promised to gut regulation of fossil fuel industries in the region and roll back climate initiatives, including the cap and trade program that Kate Brown passed through executive action in 2020. And Tina Kotek has been a supporter of it, as have the Democrats. I think that illustrates also some of where the rubber meets the road there, because progressive groups such as the Sunrise Movement have opposed cap and trade legislation and have argued that it really commodifies pollution, brings it within a market system. There are many ways these companies can work around the effects of it in ways that companies lower down in the energy system have fewer protections. So I think there are these fights ahead.
Well, Jan, the Kate Brown did much better than the cap and trade. Her executive order in 2020, but she put absolute limits on greenhouse gas emissions. Her directives had to do with limiting the overall release of carbon dioxide into the air, which is far more effective than any cap and trade.
I agree that the Democrats have embraced climate justice and doing something within the time frame set by scientists. And the Democrats have to respond to a growing movement of young people who have made this a top priority. We've also followed civil suits against big oil led by Keith Ellison of Minnesota, and he was reelected by Minnesota voters, narrowly defeating Jim Scholz, whose campaign was funded by a subsidiary of the Koch brothers. What do you make of that victory?
Well, that was very good. He was out there. He was famous as a as an attorney general for suing the oil companies. And as we've said before, the oil companies are so powerful. They're making so much money now, paradoxically, because of the war in the Ukraine, the spike upward in oil prices. But Keith Ellison has held their feet to the fire as much as one can. And it's very heartening that he was able to survive, because we need people like him. He can and has done a variety of effective moves to limit the use of fossil fuels in Minnesota. All over the country, there have been people who were identified with this issue who were successful in the midterm election.
There were some other interesting state ballots that give cause for encouragement. Of course, abortion rights were codified in many states. Marijuana was legalized. There's also this ballot measure around legal slavery, abolishing it in Alabama, Tennessee, and Vermont, as well as Oregon. It did not pass in Louisiana. What's your take on that? It was very close in Oregon.
Well,
but the amendment did pass.
It was never really the subject of much discussion. It was just kind of a floater in there. It's a effort to undo a proviso in the 13th Amendment, which allows slavery to continue effectively for prisoners. And when we've had this explosion of incarceration over the past three decades, there have been more and more people have been made aware of it because they've been subjected to work regimes within prison. I think it's a really important and really valuable passage. I don't draw a lot of significance because it was not politically an issue. I mean, if you look around at the coverage of the election, so many other issues absorbed all the available space. So I think I'm very happy that it passed. I think the fact that it was relatively close is not that important.
So that might be also something to return to around prison politics down the road.
Yes.
Well, let's talk about the Conference of the Parties 27. Such an odd term for a meeting that where so much is at stake. And Guterres also opened the conference by saying we can sign a climate solidarity pact or a collective suicide pact, in calling the attendees to action. And, you know, it may be better to frame the situation as a holdup where many nations and community are very much at hostage to the industries that are killing them. What's your take on some of the news coming out from COP27, including this campaign that's been around a while, but getting more leverage and calls for loss and damages to be paid by wealthy, high polluting countries?
Well, that's the issue. That's the one big issue that is highlighted by COP27. And you can say that it is gradually being absorbed by fossil fuel companies who have some 680 lobbyists present there to try to sell natural gas as a transitional fuel rather than as a fossil fuel, and to generally lobby and to limit damages and to avoid damages to their pocketbooks. But it is an opportunity for those parts of the world that are being devastated by climate change to speak up and ask for some forms of reparations.
The history of these conference of parties have been ones of hopes and bitter disappointments that follow, as commitments made are often not fulfilled or fulfilled at a fraction of the commitments made. It's like New Year's resolutions.
That's true. Developed societies, which now include China, acknowledge in the abstract, yes, there's the links between their own economic success and the floods in Pakistan and the damage done to island nations and problems in Africa that are the direct result of that success. And they say, we need to do something. But in terms of what, I mean, they resist the notion of liability because it makes it seem like a legal right. They definitely resist the term reparations, So the term now, the operative phrase is loss and damages. So everybody's a willing, you know, so that's a...
That's a recognized category under the law.
Yes. So there are efforts, he says, yeah, we recognize there are loss and that there are damages and there's some connection, but it's very hard to specifically link one oil refinery to the rise of one particular river in Pakistan.
And although so, apparently there's a growing technology that can pinpoint pretty accurately sources of emissions.
We'll never, you know, we don't know a lot about cause and effect in general, and we certainly are never going to be able to quantify precisely who's burning does what to who, but they can approximate much better than they could have even a decade ago. And they are making pitches in this group called the Vulnerable 20, which now includes about 50 to 60 nations in Africa and mostly in the Southern Hemisphere, are making a concerted effort to get specific and bring about the kind of detailed criticisms that will make it harder and harder for countries who have generally acknowledged obligation to squirm away from making specific reparations.
Okay, well, Mike, we'll continue to follow these developments through the lens of climate justice and organizing around climate justice. And it, as I say, it could have been worse after the midterm elections.
That's true.
Okay, take care.
You too.